everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2019, and you're listening to episode 109, The Moral Argument for the Existence of God. On this episode, I'm joined by Sarah Geis, who teaches apologetics and ethics at Denver Seminary, where she is also the director of the Gordon Lewis Center for Christian Thought and Culture. She is also a PhD student in philosophy of religion at the University of Birmingham, UK. Sarah wrote an effective evangelism article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. An effective evangelism article is a practical advice column on how to reach people of other faiths and of no faith with the gospel. Her article is called Morality, Therefore God, an Evangelistic Strategy. Sarah, it's good to have you on.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how is this particular argument important today? Especially, it seems like so many people in the world today seem to be living without any regard to morality.
Yeah, we do seem to be living in a little bit of a crazy period where just about anything goes at the moment. But one thing that is also true is that we, despite the fact that we are living in a world where anything seems to go, we are also living in a world that is full of people who get morally outraged about certain things, like saying something that excludes a certain group of people, or if you say something that offends a certain group of people. Or if you say something that seems to be a little backward, even, and not so progressive as it should be. And what's interesting about that sense of moral outrage is that even no matter how people actually act, they're still showing that we are moral creatures, that we have a sense of right and wrong and what should be and what shouldn't be, even if we're not quite accurate about how we are defining good and evil or right and wrong, but we still really desperately want to do the right thing, or at least get upset when the right thing is not done. So this argument is helpful because since it plays on people's sensibilities, it kind of trades on that interest that people have in being a moral creature. And it asks the question, okay, if you care about morality in general, then where does that come from? So that's where it I think is extremely helpful, is it takes something that everybody's interested in already for the most part, and then it drives them to the origin or the source of where that's from.
So how can having an argument like this one, the moral argument for the existence of God, even be helpful for evangelism at all? I mean, in your title, it says it's an evangelistic strategy. So how can an argument for something be an evangelistic strategy?
Well, there's two ways of looking at that. The first is that a lot of the time people think of an argument as a heated disagreement or something that hurts a relationship, or at least puts strain on a relationship. And if that's the case, then sure, it would actually be pretty counterproductive to evangelism. However, that's technically, in philosophy, that's not what an argument is. That's, if you have a heated argument, that's a certain type of argument. If you have a real aggressive argument that hurts a friendship, again, that's a certain type of argument. But the argument that I'm talking about here is simply giving reasons for a conclusion. And it's helping someone to understand that the conclusion that you are suggesting actually does have a very, very strong logical process to get there. So it doesn't have to be done in any kind of aggressive way. The other thing is that if you do these sorts of arguments, if you give arguments like the moral argument for God, then that is actually helpful for evangelism, because you aren't always dealing with people who have any interest in there being a God. You aren't always dealing with people who believe in a God. And so what this does is it clears a lot of the roadblocks for people, and it allows them to see or to care about whether or not God exists, for one, and then two, to actually have some reasons to consider it as a possibility. And then, and only then, you can move forward into later on actually talking about Jesus or talking about whether or not they actually want to make a commitment of any sort. So I think it's a pre-evangelism, which is what a lot of people call apologetics.
I'd like you to just explain to us what the moral argument itself is, and then talk about some of the key terms that, you know, is related to the moral argument. And also, I'd like you to define morality. What does it mean, you know, for our listeners? Like, everyone has probably a different idea of what they think it means to be moral or morality, and also define that for us as well.
Right. Well, whenever I teach ethics, there are several different ways of looking at morality that we have to get straight before we actually move forward. And there are different categories of moral reasoning and ethical reasoning. The first category is the idea of what should we do? What's right? What's wrong? And that's kind of an applied morality. That's what I call applied morality or applied ethics, where we ask, what should I do on a day-to-day level, on a very basic, fundamental, practical level? And then there is theoretical morality or theoretical ethics. And that is the idea that you're comparing different approaches to deciding how to live, how to act on a day-to-day level. So this is stuff like comparing utilitarianism to virtue ethics, or comparing virtue ethics to something like deontology, which is an obligation-based or duty-based ethic.
You're going to have to explain what utilitarian ethics are. I don't know if everyone listening knows what that is.
Well, I don't know that I want to go into that, but utilitarian ethics is the idea that it's the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And that's just an example of a theory that in theoretical ethics you would be comparing with other theories. But this type of ethics is not that type. This type of ethics is, or this type of morality that this argument is dealing with, is the idea that general morality, so not specific examples of moral acts and not theories, but just the concept in general, the broadest possible stroke, has to be explained somehow. So it needs some kind of explanation or account of how it existed, how it came to exist, and why we care about it and why we use it. So that is what's called meta-ethics. That's a philosophical term, and that's what this has to do with. So this argument doesn't deal at all with who's good, who's not, what acts are good, what acts are not, but it instead asks the question, why are we moral beings at all? What sorts of explanations are plausible for accounting for the origin of morality in general? So it's the biggest bird's eye view that we can take about accounting for morality. So the argument itself goes, well, people put it in some different ways, but the way that I like to defend it is where the first line, the first premise, is if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. Premise two is objective moral values do exist. And the conclusion is, therefore, God exists. So what you're trying to do here is you're trying to do two things. First, defend the existence of objective moral values. So this is the phrase that Bill Craig uses, is values. I like to also sometimes say objective moral facts, because that seems a little stronger than your personal subjective value. But the key terms here, objective and then moral values, or moral facts, if you want to insert that term, is, first of all, objective means something that's fixed, something that applies for everyone at all times. So objective, essentially another way to look at it is, it's something that, whether, even if you feel like it shouldn't be the case, you cannot change it. It's going to hold. So if murder is wrong objectively, if I were someone who felt otherwise, who felt like murder was fine, then it wouldn't matter, because that's an objective moral value or an objective moral fact. So the idea of a moral fact then is something that is, once again, a given. It's something that everyone has to deal with and come to terms with, and they themselves cannot change it. So that's essentially, moving forward, what we have to understand is that objective is the opposite of subjective, which is your personal private interpretations or feelings or desires. Objective does not care how you feel. If something is objective, then it is going to hold regardless. So that's what this argument does.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Sarah Geis, and she wrote an evangelism article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Morality, Therefore God, an Evangelistic Strategy. And her article is available free online at our website, equip.org. To read more evangelism articles like this one, please subscribe to the journal. A subscription is $33.50. And to subscribe, go to our website, equip.org. So Sarah was just kind of breaking down for us the argument, the moral argument itself. And also, I just wanted to tell people, she mentioned Bill Craig, and that would be the philosopher William Lane Craig. And we do have some articles that he's written for us on our website as well. But I'd like to ask, what kind of worldviews are opposed to the moral argument?
There are two major ones. The first one that most people will address when they're defending this argument is the idea of relativism. So that would be, if you believe in objective moral values, so once again, that the idea such as that murder is wrong objectively for all people at all times, a relativist, a moral relativist would say that that isn't necessarily true, that it depends on the situation. It depends on the person. It depends on the culture, that sort of thing. And that's a large category. That not all moral relativists are exactly the same stripe. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the other big worldview that is, I think, increasingly common, but a lot of Christians still don't realize that this needs to be dealt with, is a group of people called atheistic moral realists. So a moral realist is someone who believes that morality really exists objectively. So these are people who think that, yeah, there are objective moral values. So they'll agree with that line, that premise. But then where they disagree is they'll say, but that doesn't mean God exists. That doesn't mean that God's the origin of these objective moral values. So that is a line of reasoning that we will tackle a little bit later. But the most common, I think, group of people that you're going to face that disagree with this argument are going to be the relativists.
So then how do most apologists defend the argument in light of, you know, those two worldviews that you mentioned?
So what they tend to do, and there's nothing wrong with this, I do this too, is they will try to defend the idea that, yeah, there are actually objective moral facts, and then they will try to find evidences of these. So C.S. Lewis, in his book Abolition of Man, in the appendix, which is at the very end of the book, he gives a whole list of moral values that he thinks are universal and objective. So what he's trying to show is that across all cultures, there are certain things that every single normal human or every single normal culture does actually agree to and does believe. So what he'll say is that things like respecting your elders is something that is cross-cultural, that it doesn't depend on the culture. And then the moral relativist obviously would want to say otherwise. And specifically, this would be a cultural relativist. They would want to say, no, actually, cultures completely come up with their own set of morals, their own ethical code, because it's whatever works for them. And C.S. Lewis would say, sure, there's some of that, but there are also overarching shared values that are just built into what it means to be human. And that means that it's objective. And then obviously what he would then do and what this argument does is say, okay, then the next question is, where does this come from? And then the goal is to show that the best explanation is that God exists. So there's a lot that you can come up with here. I think it's a little, it's fascinating anthropologically to try to dig into what sorts of values morally are shared across all cultures. So another one would be that it's not a good idea to make a habit out of lying. Because then the fabric of your society is going to break down, that sort of thing. So that's generally how most people are going to defend objective moral values and deny that relativism is true.
But can Christians really prove that objective moral facts exist?
Well, and this is something that I think is often a criticism levied against this argument or levied against people who defend this argument. The issue here is twofold, though. First of all, people use the term prove often to mean, can you scientifically or physically demonstrate the existence of these things? And the answer to that is no, we can't. However, prove isn't really the right word here. I think the right word here is that we are creating a situation where the best explanation is that objective moral values do exist, that there's not a sufficient or helpful opposite. There's not a helpful alternative to that. So I think it is a plausible inference is what we're going for there.
I would like to also have you kind of explain to us the other way to defend the existence of moral facts. And you covered this in your article too.
Yeah. So like I just said, the first way that's most common is if you encounter a relativist, someone who says, no, objective moral facts don't exist, so I have no reason to believe in God, then you can, like I said, you can defend the idea that there are, in fact, objective moral values. Then you've defeated the relativist if that works. But the other way, I think, is a lot stronger. And this is something that I haven't really seen people do very often. But if you think about the options here, if you're dealing with a relativist, the other option is to believe in some degree of objective moral facts. And if you can show that relativism itself is incoherent or is logically flawed in some way, then the only other live option there is to be a non-relativist or someone who believes in objective reality to some extent. So what I try to do is I try to show that relativism itself, ethical relativism, is actually an argument that's called a reductio ad absurdum, which means that if you reduce this argument to its logical conclusion, it's absurd and untenable. So what I do is I'll say that, first of all, cultural relativism, because it's the most popular, it's the most common and academically hot right now kind of way to be a relativist. What it shows or what it argues is that each culture gets to determine what's right for itself. Each culture is in a different context than every other culture, a different time. So, you know, cultures back in the past count as a different culture. So, for example, our grandparents' generation would count as a different culture. And each culture just determines its own moral code. And so the implication there is you can't judge any other culture for a moral code or a moral value that you think is wrong because you're not in that culture. So the idea here is to show that there are reasons to believe that cultural relativism is untenable and reduces to what's called individual relativism. And individual relativism, I'll just say really quickly, is the idea that each individual gets to determine what's right for himself or herself. So here's how I do that. And it's not just me who makes this argument. There's actually an atheistic philosopher who was a very, very good ethicist named James Rachels, who wrote a book called The Elements of Moral Philosophy. And James Rachels made the argument that cultures is a flexible term. You can't determine the boundaries of a culture because there are subcultures within a culture. And there are people who are kind of crossovers where they have a couple of different cultures that they're dealing with. And so the boundaries are flexible and movable and permeable. So if that's the case, then what James Rachel says is the idea is that basically you can keep reducing a culture down. So you can say, okay, there are teenagers in this culture who have a distinct subculture than everyone else. Then there are Christian teenagers who have a distinct subculture. Then there are male Christian teenagers. And then he keeps going down and down and down until you get to the individual. And he says that the individual is its own or his own or her own culture, essentially. So his argument is cultural relativism does not make sense because you cannot actually cleanly define what counts as a culture. So if that's the case, and individual relativism is basically what you're left with, then every individual gets to determine his or her own morality. And then what Rachel says is that's absurd, because what that requires is that morality is really nothing to speak of or nothing to argue about or nothing to discuss, because none of us, I can't understand your morality and you can't understand my morality, and whoever we meet tomorrow, we won't be able to understand them. So there's really no such thing as morality at all. It's just things we do and things we think, and it's not really any sort of overarching code or guide or law. So the argument here is cultural relativism reduces to individual relativism. Individual relativism can't maintain any sort of morality. Therefore, both sets of relativisms are false. They have to be false because they're absurd. And if that's the case, then the only other alternative is to accept that there are some degrees or some types of objective morals out there.
I also want to let our listeners know that we went a little bit more in depth on this subject, and we have an article free online at our website called There's Something About Relativism. And it was a rebuttal to an opinion piece in the New York Times by Columbia University professor of philosophy, Dr. Carol Rovane, and we deal with refuting cultural moral relativism. So I just want to mention that as well. So if moral facts exist, why does that mean that God exists?
Well, this trades on a philosophical and logical term called the principle of sufficient reason. And this comes from Gottfried Leibniz, a philosopher that was part of the Enlightenment. And this principle states that everything that exists has a sufficient explanation for that existence. So it doesn't mean a cause necessarily. It just means it doesn't exist without reason. So an example that I use in this article is that if a purple elephant just appears in the sky and is hovering above people, we're not gonna simply think to ourselves, oh, that's weird. That kind of thing just happens though, and then move on with our lives. We're gonna try to figure out where it's coming from. What is the explanation for this? And morality is sort of similar in the sense that if it exists, if there are objective moral truths, objective moral facts out there, it would be bizarre of us to not ask the question, why do they exist and where do they come from? So that is where that last move of this argument goes. It says, first of all, if objective moral facts exist, then God exists. That's premise one. Premise two is objective moral facts do exist. And then the last premise is, therefore, God exists. So the reason it's saying, therefore, God exists is because these moral facts, first of all, they do seem to give us a code of living. So things like, once again, don't murder. Some stuff in the Ten Commandments. We can look at the Ten Commandments. We can say, don't covet your neighbor's wife. Don't want your neighbor's stuff, you know, and that sort of thing is... those are all objective moral facts, but there's a second stage here that is the moral obligation piece. So when we deal with moral facts, we're not just dealing with rules. We're also dealing with a sense of obligation to those rules. We're dealing with a reality and a context where when we don't follow those rules, we are, one, often held accountable culturally, and then two, it's not good for us, and we actually find ourselves being fairly unhealthy as human beings because we weren't made to function like that. So the idea here is when you are dealing with the existence of facts plus some sort of human obligation to those facts, then all of a sudden you have to ask, who says I should follow these rules? What happens if I don't? Who cares if I don't feel like it? And that is where, when I teach ethics in a secular school, secular context, this is where people really start to pay attention, because they want to be good. They want to believe that they're good. They want to believe people in general are generally basically good. But then the question that I will always ask them is, why should we care? Why do we care? Why does it matter if we follow these rules or not? And once again, the best explanation for a moral code that we are obligated to follow is that it comes from a moral code giver, someone who not just wrote it, but gave it to us to follow. And that requires that the source of these things be something with a will, something with the capacity to make decisions and issue commands and then actually give those commands or build those commands into the creation and the people that are meant to receive it. And the best account of that is God. So the Euthyphro dilemma comes from ancient Greece. It was Plato who wrote the dialogue called Euthyphro. And there's a little dilemma, moral dilemma in there that where we draw it out, and it was originally about polytheism, which is many gods, but we can make it about one god. And the question that Socrates asks this individual that he encounters in this dialogue is, okay, how do you know that what you're doing is right? Basically, is it right because the gods are pleased, or God is pleased when you do it? Or is it right because somehow it's what God actually commands? So if the gods are just pleased because we do it, then it exists outside of the gods or God. If God is the one who commands it, then God is the source of morality. So what he's actually suggesting there is that morality has to have some sort of link to God in some way, either morality. And the conclusion that Plato comes to actually is that morality is a sort of God. It's the good. And then later on, Augustine said, oh, wow, that's a really good point, Plato. Maybe it is the good, but God is the source of the good. God, the good is located in God, or is a part of God, or is God. And so basically the best explanation for where morality comes from is in fact a moral law giver who is the source of, or even identical with, the good.
I also want to let our listeners know that we have various articles on the Euthyphro Dilemma, and one of them, that's the title of the article, The Euthyphro Dilemma, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. I'd like to go back to the other worldview you mentioned earlier and have you unpack it for us. So how might a non-relativistic atheist or agnostic, you know, object to the moral argument?
Generally, what they'll do, and there are very well-known atheistic philosophers who subscribe to this. Shelley Kagan is one that you can look up. Sam Harris is one. These guys are very, very vocal about saying, we can believe in objective morals, objective facts exist, but there's no reason to believe that God exists in light of that or because of that. So what they will say is that essentially we are obligated, we feel obligated to certain moral facts because it's good for society, or it's good for how we are made as humans. Not made, that's the wrong way to put it, but how we function as humans. So they'll say you don't murder because if everyone did it, is one line of reasoning, then we would all be wiped off the face of the earth. So it's just a given. It's a fact that all of us would decide or evolve to believe that you don't murder. That's wrong. So it's a naturalistic way of looking at moral facts, but they'll still say, yeah, there are things that you should and shouldn't do objectively, regardless of how you feel about it. And then they'll say, but because there are naturalistic explanations of that. So we do these things because they're good for us, or we do these things because society will break down if we don't, those sorts of things. They'll say, there's no need to appeal to God. There's no need to say God is the one who set all this in motion and who made us feel obligated to it. So this is a really, I think, interesting line of reasoning that Christians need to brush up on and need to get a lot more proficient with, because we do need to learn how to articulate the reality that it makes no sense that we should care so much about morality unless we were made to care, unless there's a God who actually built us to love and to seek relationships and to do things that are far more complex and morally driven than mere survival. So this, like I said, it's not as common as relativism, but it's getting there. It's getting more common every day. And it's therefore something that we really need to pay close attention to it. Something you can watch is William Lane Craig actually a few years ago had a debate with Shelley Kagan, who is a, like I said, an atheistic moral realist, believes that morals are real without God. And that's on YouTube. So you can look that up and watch it. And it is, I think, a really good primer to this sort of reasoning.
I also want our listeners to know, if you want to dig more in depth into this whole entire article, we have an article that's free online on our website, and it's called Atheists and the Quest for Objective Morality. And so you can look that up to read more about this topic. And finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Sarah. So Sarah, I was looking up some lists of kind of like bucket list things to eat in the Denver area. And I know you're in that area of Colorado. And so there was this big long list. So I'd like to ask you about two of them. So would you rather eat bison short ribs or cheddar goldfish ice cream?
Ooh, bison short ribs, definitely. I'm a cheddar purist.
And I know that sounds just so pop culture, like putting goldfish into ice cream. And I know it's pretty cold and it's always snowing over there. So skiing or ice skating?
Oh, I would say ice skating.
And would you rather dress up or dress down casual?
Definitely dress down. I am a major dresser down.
More casual, I guess. Is it hard to dress up when it's so cold?
It is. You have to dress in layers. And I really, especially like Carhartt, which is a ranch brand. And so it is impossible to look businesslike or classy when you wear that kind of stuff. But you're warm. So that's what matters.
With the cold temperatures out there, I think that's the most important thing. Well, thank you, Sarah, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Today's guest is Sarah Geis, and she wrote an evangelism article for the Christian Research Journal. It's called Morality, Therefore God, an Evangelistic Strategy. It's available free online at our website, equip.org. To read more evangelism articles like this one, please subscribe to the journal. A subscription is $33.50, and to subscribe, go online and visit our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.